Hi everyone, welcome back to another segment of Go Sports Crazy with your host, DJ Takeoff, only on Penguin Radio. Last week, we covered what was going on in the NBA with the Western and Eastern Conference Finals, talked about what college football was doing with their upcoming seasons and the coronavirus, and talked about the social issues present with teams in the NFL taking a knee and staying in their locker rooms during the opening national anthem. Tonight, we got a great show ahead. The NBA playoffs are still going on, so I'll be talking updates with both the Western Conference Finals and Eastern Conference Finals to start off. Then I will talk about the WNBA playoffs and everything going on with that. And then we will revisit the NFL and talk about some of the top teams and players playing in the league. So let's get started with a look into the NBA Finals, starting with the West Side and the Los Angeles Lakers and Denver Nuggets matchup. We officially have ourselves a series. The Denver Nuggets picked up an impressive 114-106 Game 3 win over the Los Angeles Lakers on Tuesday night to cut the Lakers' Western Conference Finals lead to 2-1. Jamal Murray was absolutely brilliant all night, nearly putting up a triple-double and hitting big shots in the fourth quarter when the Lakers launched a late comeback bid. The Lakers were outplayed for most of the night, but cut the lead to 5 early in the third quarter. Denver pulled away after that, however, extending the lead to as many as 18 points in the third before the Lakers launched one final comeback in the fourth quarter. That's when Jamal Murray came to the rescue, sealing the game for the Denver Nuggets. He finished with 28 points, 12 assists, and 8 rebounds on the night. Nikola Jokic, who had 22 points, 10 rebounds, and 5 assists, had another strong game for the Nuggets, with Jeremy Grant coming up with a huge offensive performance, scoring a playoff career of 26 points. LeBron James, who had 30 points, 11 assists, and 10 rebounds, and Anthony Davis, who had 27 points, again led the way for the Lakers, with Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, also known as KCP, adding 12 points to the loss. Denver will look to ride the momentum and even the series in Game 4 on Thursday night. Here are four takeaways from the Nuggets' big Game 3 win. Number 1, Jamal Murray saves the day, again. There's not much more you can say about Jamal Murray. He dominated Game 3 offensively for the entire night, being patient and orchestrating the offense. But even more impressive was how he responded when the Lakers made their fourth quarter run. The Nuggets were going absolutely nowhere offensively, somewhat befuddled by a rare zone defense from Los Angeles, when Murray hit a clutch three-pointer to increase the lead to 7 points with just over 2 minutes remaining. He followed that up with a late shot clock assist to Paul Millsap for a dunk, then hit an absolute dagger to seal the victory with 53 seconds left. It's one thing to play loose and free when your team is ahead, but what Jamal Murray did was special. Not that we haven't seen it from him before. We all knew the Lakers would go on a run, and so many times in these playoffs alone, we've seen teams fold after giving up big leads. Murray simply wouldn't let that happen and save the Nuggets' season in the process. If they lose, they go down 3-0 and basically have no chance. Instead, they're now down 2-1 with all the momentum heading into Game 4. It's hard to think of any player who has improved their stock more than Jamal Murray has in these playoffs. Number 2. Emotional hangover for Anthony Davis? If you didn't see Game 3, you'd look at the box score and see Anthony Davis's 27 points and think he had a great game. It's a testament to how great he is that he can put up numbers like that in the Western Conference Finals, yet still underperform. Anthony Davis, a mid-range master for most of the postseason, wasn't hitting his assortments of pull-ups and step-backs on Tuesday, but instead of trying to get to the basket more, he looked largely passive. He didn't even get a single rebound until the fourth quarter, and failed to pick up a block shot, a pretty good indication that he wasn't quite there with his energy level. Davis was coming off the biggest moment of his NBA career on Sunday with the game buzzer beater, So it's fair to wonder whether he was suffering from a slight emotional hangover in terms of his intensity. It has also a lot to do with Denver's defense, which did a better job of keeping the Lakers out of the paint for a lot of the night. Despite his subpar performance, Anthony Davis still put up the numbers, which is what great players do. I'm expecting him to come out more aggressively in Game 4. Number 3, Jeremy Grant steps up. With Murray and Jokic playing so consistently, all the Nuggets really need is more players to contribute significantly on any given night. On Tuesday, it was Jeremy Grant, who is absolutely tremendous on both ends of the floor. The 6'8 wing always brings the energy on defense, but he had struggled offensively after the opening round Utah series, averaging 8.8 points on 36% field goals and 26% three-pointers against the Clippers and Lakers. He broke out of that slump in an impressive way in Game 3, scoring the majority of his career playoff high 26 points by going to the basket and getting to the free throw line rather than just making three-pointers. He went 2-for-5 from deep, but he took 12 free throws in Game 3, making 10, after shooting just 18 in the previous 9 games combined. Watch how Grant quickly attacks the closeout and seeks contact in the lane the next game. We hadn't seen this a lot from him recently. Grant isn't going to score 20-plus points every night, but he'll benefit the Nuggets tremendously if he keeps up this level of aggression moving forward in the series. Number 4, Lakers go cold. The concern over the Lakers' three-point shooting had largely been eliminated during the postseason so far. They shot 39% from the three-point line in the first 2 games against the Nuggets. But on Tuesday, we saw what happens when the shots don't go down. The Lakers went 6-for-26 from deep in Game 3, including 2-for-18 from LeBron, Davis, Danny Green, Rajon Rondo, and Alex Caruso combined. The Nuggets, like every team, are focusing so much attention on LeBron James and Anthony Davis that role players will consistently get clean looks. But none of them are true knockdown shooters, even though Caldwell Pope has certainly looked like one. The Lakers were due for a cold shooting night, and the Nuggets took advantage. We'll see which way things swing in Game 4. Despite 2 entertaining conference finals being played, the NBA TV ratings are down, according to a report by Real GM. The Game 2 thriller between the Lakers and the Denver Nuggets, which went right down to the wire and concluded with an Anthony Davis 3-point shot, averaged only 3.7 million viewers. That made the Lakers-Nuggets Game 2 the least-watched conference final game since 2003. With so much going on in the Orlando bubble, it is difficult to keep up with the latest NBA news updates. President Donald Trump has often come out in the media and expressed his displeasure over the highly political NBA. Trump and the Republicans believe that athletes should concentrate on their sport instead of indulging in political activism. Notably, LeBron James and other NBA stars have been criticized by Trump for their involvement in fighting social injustice and police brutality. Trump had used this as an excuse for the NBA TV ratings being down, insinuating that viewers were not interested in a politically active league. But the actual reason for the NBA TV ratings being down is the fact that this is the first time the playoffs have clashed with the NFL season, as well as other sports such as the NHL and MLB, which have also returned. This has led to a sharp drop in the viewer count. In their previous meeting, Anthony Davis snatched victory from Denver's hands with the first playoff buzzer beater of his career. The Nuggets came out to make a statement and dominated LA for the majority of Game 3, extending their lead to as many as 20 points throughout the game. The Lakers did go on a last-minute push and narrow the gap to 3 points, but Jamal Murray made sure history would not repeat itself and put the game to bed with a couple of late threes, securing Denver's first win of the series. "We feel like we should have been up 2-1 now, to be honest," Jamal Murray said after the win. The Nuggets have already come back from 2 3-1 deficits in the 2020 NBA playoffs. In the previous series, they fell behind the LA Clippers after falling to seal a victory in Game 3 despite a solid performance, as they did in Game 2 against the Lakers. Murray admitted he could see similarities between the two playoff losses, but he said the Nuggets made sure not to let the Game 2 loss get into their heads. I thought tonight we had a hit-first mentality, especially in the first quarter. Kind of took off from there, Murray said. We got everybody into a groove. Guys were playing at a higher rate. We were rebounding, running. We just had the flow. Those games hurt, but it feels better when you bounce back the way we did tonight. Like I said, we bounce back the way we do, we'll be fine. We're back in the series. Lakers head coach Frank Vogel admitted his team did not match Denver's energy up until their short-lived rally in the fourth quarter. But he expressed hope the painful defeat would rekindle LA's desire and prompt them to play with urgency in Game 4. LA's desire and prompt to play with urgency in Game 4 is telling by when Frank Vogel says, "This is the playoffs. We have to respond to a loss, and you know we know how resilient this team is. And also, we have to come out with a great fight in Game 4. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll be back with another segment on Go Sports Crazy with your host, DJ Takeoff, only on Penguin Radio. Welcome back to Go Sports Crazy with your host, DJ Takeoff, only on Penguin Radio. Next, we will take a look on what is going on the East Side with the Boston Celtics and Miami Heat Eastern Conference Finals Series. Tyler Herro was already a story before Game 4 of the Eastern Conference Finals. The rookie had exploded for 18 first-half points in Game 3, including a flurry of threes that kept the Miami Heat's offense afloat. He was averaging 14.8 points, 4 assists, and 5.7 rebounds in the playoffs, giving Miami extra playmaking beyond what Jimmy Butler, Goran Dragic, and Bam Adebayo provided. But he didn't have a game like this on his resume. Herro poured in 37 points off the bench against the Boston Celtics on Wednesday, propelling the Heat to a 112-109 victory and taking a 3-1 series lead. And he did it in an efficient fashion, 14 for 21 shooting and 5 for 10 from deep. He punished Boston's weaker defenders, exploiting its drop coverage and pick and rolls, and after he'd heated up, he didn't care who was guarding him. With about 4 minutes left in the fourth quarter, Herro isolated against all-world defender Marcus Smart and launched a jumper from several feet behind the three-point line. Smart contested it just fine, but it dropped through the net, earning a bang from Mike Breen on the broadcast. The context of those makes are the big separators in this league, Miami coach Eric Spoelstra said. Those are pressure shots. We had to step up against a really good defense. He was making plays at the end of the clock, and that's a skill set that he has. Miami had a 12-point lead in the third quarter, largely because of its defense, which took the Celtics completely out of rhythm. Boston star Jason Tatum didn't score a single point in the first half, and the Heat's 2-3 zone once again proved disruptive. But Tatum picked things up and finished the game with a team-high 28 points on a 10-for-22 shooting. Remarkable stuff from someone who was out of sorts for so long. Even when the Celtics got going, though, Miami was able to match their playmaking and defensive versatility with its own. Bam Adebayo continued to give Boston trouble. He scored 20 points on a 7-for-11 shooting with the 12 rebounds, 4 assists, 2 steals, and an incalculable amount of activity at the bottom of the Heat zone. Butler and Dragic weren't all that efficient shooting-wise, but they made clutch plays and kept Miami steady on offense. The Celtics had a chance right down to the end, but couldn't overcome their 19 turnovers. The Heat had only 8. Miami has a chance to punch its finals ticket in Game 5 on Friday. Here are 3 takeaways from Game 4. Number 1. Miami always has answers. The Heat were in control for most of this game, but it's not a small thing that Boston took a 1-point lead in the first quarter and they didn't waver. Miami wasn't shaken by Tatum's resurgence and Smart's playmaking. He had 5 assists in the third quarter. Or the Celtics starting to look like themselves offensively. This is who the Heat are. They have the personnel to respond to runs, to adjust within and between games, to attack defenses in multiple ways. Boston coach Brad Stevens accurately said that Hero was the difference in the game. The rim must have looked like the ocean to him, he said, but it's not as if Miami reoriented its entire attack around the 20-year-old. He's not a rookie anymore, Spoelstra said. We need his skill set. Does that mean it's going to translate into that kind of point production every night? No, it doesn't. I mean, we're not necessarily built like that. It's different guys and contributions from a lot of different guys. But Boston was jamming up, as they tend to do. First, second, sometimes third options out of what we were looking for. And Tyler was able to generate a lot of offense on random situations, which you need against a very good defense. Hero is technically still a rookie, but it was clear in the seeding games that he had improved over the hiatus. He became a more polished creator, consistently marrying his shot-making moxie with court vision. In the playoffs, Miami has exceeded expectations by increasing Drakic's minutes, empowering Hero and playing Adebayo exclusively at the center. Spoelstra always has a multitude of playmakers on the floor, a necessity against a defense as stingy as the Celtics. For most of the fourth, he had Drakic, Hero, Butler, and Adebayo and Andre Iguodala on the court together. Tonight was my night to score, Hero said. And next game, I'm sure it'll be different. This is the significance of Hero's eruption. The Heat always seem to have answers, even against a team that is full of firepower, well-coached, smart, and switchable. When Boston tried trapping Butler, there was Iguodala making a perfect pass out of the short roll. When it went to its small lineup, the Heat crashed the boards and Adebayo presented problems in the paint. Hero, by the way, said he'd been playing like this his whole life. Before Kentucky, before the NBA, I grew up with the ball in my hands, making plays and making tough shots, he said. I feel like that's my game. Then he pointed out that plenty of the players don't get an opportunity like him, with coaches and teammates who trust him to do his thing on this kind of stage. Hero was erroneously labeled as a catch-and-shoot guy coming into the league, and if he were in another system, that might not be who he is. Number 2. Boston's lament. This is so far from a typical 3-1 series. Both teams have scored a total of 441 points, but that's cold comfort for a Celtics team that had a 20% turnover rate on Wednesday. Boston has generally been trying to attack the soft spots in the Heat's zone and exploit their weaker defenders in man-to-man, but its game three's win wasn't earned with aggressiveness alone. It was also decisive and purposeful. For far too many possessions in the first half of Game 4, it was unclear what exactly the Celtics were trying to accomplish on offense. And after an impressive response in the third quarter, Boston got sloppy again in the fourth. Coming to the series, I was optimistic about the Celtics based on the return of Hayward and the assumption that they'd find it easier to get a flow against Miami than they did against the Toronto Raptors. Hayward has indeed helped, and Boston's offensive rating has jumped from 106.4 against Toronto to 113.4 in this round. But it has much less margin for error now that it is battling a Heat team that is getting so much out of their half-court offense. If the state of the series was different, it would be easy to point to the Celtics' second-half comeback as a sign of good things to come. That could still be the case, but now that they're facing elimination, silver linings don't mean much. Those aimless first-half possessions loom large. Number 3. The Heat didn't even shoot well. Miami won a conference finals game despite Jae Crowder going 1-for-9 and 1-for-7 from deep, and Duncan Robinson missing all 5 of his shots, including 4 threes. Heat players not named Tyler Hero went 5-for-27 from 3-point range, and Boston equaled their 38 points in the paint. The lesson here, getting to the free throw line matters. Miami went 24-for-27, and the Celtics went 17-for-21. And taking care of the ball really matters. Let's take another quick break, and I'll be back with updates on some NBA social justice action and what's going on in the WNBA playoff bubble, as their season is winding down for them too. Tune in for more on Go Sports Crazy with your host, DJ Takeoff, only on Penguin Radio. Welcome back to Go Sports Crazy with your host, DJ Takeoff, only on Penguin Radio. We're back looking on some NBA social justice action and what's going on in the WNBA playoff bubble with their series starting up. Let's start with the NBA social justice action. Both the Celtics and Heat have taken social action during the playoffs. A Jefferson County, Kentucky grand jury on Wednesday declined to bring charges against three white Louisville police officers for the killing of Breonna Taylor, a 26-year-old African-American woman who has been the focus of NBA players' quest for justice since the NBA's restart. Brett Hankinson was indicted on three counts of first-degree wanton endangerment in connection with the fatal shooting, and his bond was set at $15,000. The charges each carry a maximum length of 5 years in prison. Hankinson was fired from the police force in June. The other two officers, Miles Cosgrove and John Mattingly, were not charged in the case. Members of the Miami Heat and Boston Celtics resumed the Eastern Conference Finals Wednesday with heavy hearts and a reluctant focus on basketball. "It's tough," said Celtics guard Jaylen Brown after Miami's 112-109 win over Boston. "To be honest, I wasn't surprised by the verdict. It's hard to gather the words, but I wasn't surprised. I think that in society, the way it was built, the intentions were never to protect and serve people of color initially. So when they were gearing for what was about to happen, I knew that the wrong decision was probably going to be made. Until we dismantle, recreate, or change the system that we have, it's going to continue to have victims like Breonna Taylor and others that fall victim to oppression." Let's switch gears to the WNBA and what has been going on in their playoff bubble. The Seattle Storm and Minnesota Lynx are set to start the WNBA playoff series. The Seattle Storm and Minnesota Lynx were prepared to take the court on Tuesday night, 2 days after Game 1 of their WNBA playoff semifinal that was postponed because of an inconclusive COVID-19 test. WNBA Commissioner Kathy Engelbert said three players on the Storm had inconclusive results from Sunday from tests they took the day before. So the league decided to postpone the scheduled opener of the best-of-five playoff series. "The health and safety of all players and staff continue to be our top priority. After comprehensive consultation with health and safety specialists following the additional testing of Seattle's players and staff, as well as the implementation of contact tracing, we feel confident in moving forward with the Storm and Lynx taking the court for Game 1 of their semifinal series," Engelbert said. "We are closely monitoring the situation and are coordinating with medical specialists." The Storm players underwent additional testing, and all three were cleared before game time. "The balloon popped," Seattle coach Gary Kloppenburg said about the postponement. We were all prepared to play, and then it all hit with the fan pretty quick from there. "It was deflating, in a way, the uncertainty of the situation. Fortunately, we got them back. We were able to get on the court today with a couple of them." Kloppenburg said other teams go through similar situations during the regular season, helped ease the concerns of his players since there had been a few inconclusive tests before. He wasn't concerned about their focus heading into the opener. "This team has been good at putting this behind them and moving on," he said. The first game of the series was scheduled to tip at 9 p.m. It was originally scheduled to be the earlier game on Tuesday, but the league switched it with the other semifinal between the Las Vegas Aces and Connecticut to give it more time to make sure that there wasn't an infection or more exposure to the virus in the WNBA bubble. "We were advised by the infectious disease specialist to make that decision," Engelbert said. "Every day is a new day in COVID world. This was not made to clear a specific player." The league said all players and staff remaining in the playoffs will continue being tested under its health and safety protocols. I'm confident that the league isn't going to take any chances when it comes to our safety, Lynx star Nafisa Collier said. I know whoever takes the court tonight is 100% cleared. The WNBA made it through their regular season with a few false positive tests for the coronavirus, but no players developed COVID-19 once the season started. While those players had to miss a game, no contests were canceled until Sundays because of the coronavirus fears. We are constantly monitoring it, Engelbert said. With all the changes we had this year, the virus is one that every day gets reset to zero. The season is being played inside a bubble environment at IMG Academy in Florida. Seattle, which finished 18-4, received a double bye to the semifinals and hadn't played since getting routed by Las Vegas on the final day of the regular season. The Storm have won 6 straight against the Minnesota Lynx, including both regular season meetings this year. Now, we're going to take a quick look at some of the top players in the WNBA. The 2020 WNBA playoffs are in full swing, and we've already seen some thrilling action as the Phoenix Mercury's Shea Petty hit a buzzer beater in the first round to eliminate the defending champion Washington Mystics. On Sunday, the semifinal series got underway with the Las Vegas Aces facing the Connecticut Sun, and the Seattle Storm taking on the Minnesota Lynx. Along with the playoffs, it is also award season. So far, the league announced 4 major honors. MVP, Rookie of the Year, Coach of the Year, and Sixth Woman of the Year. Still to come are Defensive Player of the Year and Most Improved Player. In addition, the league will also announce the All-WNBA teams and All-Rookie team. Here's a rundown of the award winners that have been announced so far. MVP, Asia Wilson, Las Vegas Aces. Averaging 20.5 points, 8.5 rebounds, and 2 blocks per game, Wilson led the Aces to an 18-4 record in the number 1 seed. As a result, she ran away with MVP, falling 4 votes shy of winning the award unanimously. Now in her 3rd season, Wilson has won MVP, Rookie of the Year, and made 2 All-Star games. Over the next month, she'll try to add WNBA champion to that resume as she leads into the Aces in the playoffs. Rookie of the Year, Crystal Dangerfield, Minnesota Lynx. Dangerfield made history, becoming the first second-round pick to win Rookie of the Year. Putting up 16.2 points and 3.6 assists per game, Dangerfield led the Lynx in both categories and finished second and first, respectively, among rookies. She was a huge part of the Lynx's success this season, stepping up in the absence of star center Sylvia Fowles, who went down with a calf injury, and helping Minnesota finish in 4th place. Coach of the Year, Cheryl Reeve, Minnesota Lynx. With Maya Moore sitting out again, Simone Augustus off to Los Angeles, and Sylvia Fowles out injured for much of the season, Reeve faced a unique challenge leading a Lynx team without any members of that core that won 4 championships last decade. It turned out not to be much of a problem, though, as Reeve guided the Lynx to a 14-8 record and a 4th place finish that was their best since 2017. This is the 3rd time Reeve has won Coach of the Year, trying a WNBA record. Sixth Woman of the Year, Derica Hamby, Las Vegas Aces. This one isn't as much of a surprise. Aces forward Derica Hamby is a Sixth Woman of the Year, taking 44 out of 47 possible votes to become the 3rd player in the league to win this award in 2 straight seasons. She puts up 13 points, 7.1 rebounds, 2.7 assists, and 1.7 steals per game, setting new career heights in all of those categories save for rebounding. Hamby could easily start and actually does play starter-level minutes for the Aces, but has grown comfortable in her role as their game-changing sixth woman. The 2020 WNBA playoffs have arrived at the semifinal stage, and after things hit a bit of a snog on Sunday due to the COVID tests for the Seattle Storm players, the action resumed in full on Tuesday night, and it did not disappoint. The Las Vegas Aces evened up their series with the Connecticut Sun at 1-1 with some late heroics from MVP Asia Wilson, while the Seattle Storm jumped out to a 1-0 lead over Minnesota Lynx thanks to the buzzer beater by Alicia Clark. Due to the coronavirus pandemic, there were all sorts of necessary changes, and this has been by far the most unique season in league history. Play didn't get started until late July, and the regular season had to be shortened to 22 games. Let's take one more quick break before we return to talk about updates on the NFL and how teams are adjusting getting back to play. Tune in for more on Go Sports Crazy with your host, DJ Takeoff, only on Penguin Radio. Welcome back to Go Sports Crazy with your host, DJ Takeoff, only on Penguin Radio. Let's take a look on what has been going on in the NFL. We've had to piece together teams these first 2 weeks as the pass catchers of our teams. Chris Godwin, George Kittle, A.J. Brown, Kenny Golladay, Jamison Crowder, Sterling Shepard, Deebo Samuel, Jalen Reagor, and Jack Doyle all have missed at least one of the first two games or will miss this week. We've starred in honor as viable running backs sift through our fingers, like we've tried to pick up sand with our fingers spread apart, as Miles Sanders, Raheem Mostert, Le'Veon Bell, James Conner, Philip Lindsay, James White, and Tevin Coleman all missed at least one of the first two games, or they will not play this weekend. And it's not looking good for Cam Akers and Malcolm Brown either. We gasped in shock as Cortland Sutton and Marlon Mack were lost for the year. Their season's over before they even started, and it's not looking good for Karis Campbell. We pounded the table and screamed at the sky when first rounders started going down. It started with Michael Thomas, and then this past week, the consensus number one pick in fantasy, in many ways the face of fantasy football for so many of us, Christian McCaffrey, gets hurt and is expected to miss 4 to 6 weeks with a high ankle sprain. These are the times that tries men and women's souls, indeed. And as we were on the floor staring at the tatters of all the teams, trying to make sense of what the cruel mistress named fantasy football has put us all through in the first 2 weeks, the bottom fell out to a depth that was never imagined. Saquon Barkley, out for the year. A consensus top four pick in fantasy football this year, Saquon Barkley was drafted either first or second overall, in a whopping 55% of the millions upon millions of ESPN leagues this season. More than half our leagues have seen one of their top two picks lost for the season, with only a game and a half to show for it. Add in that the other top pick, McCaffrey, is gone for potentially half the regular season of fantasy, and it's enough to make even the toughest fantasy football player think about calling it a day. As we head into week 3 of the NFL, let's take a look at some of the quarterbacks and team matchups. First, we have Kyle Murray in the Cardinals versus the Detroit Lions. You won't worry with Kyle Murray. I'm getting higher on Kyler. If it's fantasy points you curry, time to start Kyler Murray. Yeah, the only thing missing from Kyler Murray's season so far is a great catchphrase. Clearly, we are all still in workshopping mode. He's an obvious name, of course, but he makes the love list this week because I have him as a top two play overall. The highest I had ever seen from him ahead of, yes, Patrick Mahomes. The fourth best quarterback in fantasy so far this season. Murray has at least 25 completions and 8 rush attempts in each game this season. He also leads all quarterbacks in rushing yards and is second in rushing touchdowns behind only Cam Newton. Numbers, eye tests, everything is trending to the positive for the second-year quarterback. And now for the Detroit Lions, for whom everything is trending to the well where Lions football always trends. Matt Patricia's defense has given up 5 touchdown passes in its past 5 quarters of play and 38 total since the start of last season. Third most in the league. Detroit versus everybody? In fantasy football, it's every quarterback versus Detroit. Next, we have Josh, Allen and the Buffalo Bills versus the LA Rams. 2 weeks into the season, Allen is QB2. So what? He's played two bad teams. You say that he has, I say. And stop yelling at your screen, I can't hear you. But he has been on the love list for two consecutive weeks, and he stays on. Even facing a good team where he'll get chased around by Aaron Donald. Here's why you need to get on board that Allen is legit and not just a guy dominating weaklings who will then hear an inspiration speech and come back to beat him. In 2019, he had 28.8 attempts a game and 58.8 completion with 6.7 YPA. In 2020, he's had 40.5 attempts a game, 70.4% completion, and a 9 YPA. We know all about Allen's high fantasy floor due to his legs, but the increase in passing volume and efficiency gives him a massive fantasy ceiling too. He's more accurate, and the addition of wide receiver Stephon Diggs has been a hit. Even if Allen doesn't keep throwing 40 plus times a game, even a modest increase over his 2019 passing numbers makes him a top 10 fantasy QB every week, regardless of the opponent. Next, we have Gardner Minshew in the Jaguars versus the Dolphins. Minshew is apparently taking his beer campaign about deserving to be the number one pick in fantasy this season very seriously. He posted 20-plus fantasy points and 3 passing touchdowns in each of his first 2 games. Currently a top 12 quarterback on the season, he has all the ingredients to continue to be a fantasy football star. Pass-happy offense, nice rushing floor, 6 in rush attempts and yards among all quarterbacks since the start of last season, a terrible defense, and he leads the league in big mustache energy, which absolutely should be a thing. Even if wide receiver DJ Clark misses the game, he's questionable as of this writing. I love the matchup with a Dolphins squad that has given up the most fantasy points to quarterbacks and just ruled out starting corner Byron Jones. I love Minshew to keep his fantasy managers. And Bud Light brand managers as well, feeling good on Thursday night. Remember back when teams were extra protective of rookie quarterbacks and limited their throwing? Joe Burrow and the Bengals are top 5 in the NFL in both overall and red zone pass percentage. Cincinnati's Lions should be able to protect him on Sunday against the Eagles' defense that is 19th in the presser percentage so far this season. When not pressured, Burrow has completed 66.2% of his passes with 2 touchdowns and no interceptions. Refuse to believe that Ryan Tannehill is a real thing at your own peril. 9 straight games with 2-plus passing touchdowns, and now he gets 11 players Minnesota generously describes as a defense. Tannehill is a great streaming option for Week 3. Atlanta allowed the top-scoring quarterback in fantasy in both Weeks 1 and 2. That means those in deeper leagues, two quarterback opponent, Mitchell Trubisky. He's actually been decent this season, and he plays for the Atlanta Falcons. Don't look now, but the Bears are 2-0, and Trubisky is averaging 18 fantasy points a game. I was mean to the Lions' defense, so let's be nice to their quarterback, Matthew Stafford, had big numbers against the Cardinals last season. 385 yards, 3 scores, and he should have nice numbers assuming wide receiver Kenny Golladay returns in what should be a high-scoring game versus an Arizona defense that has yielded a whopping 41 passing touchdowns since the start of last season. I hope you've enjoyed this week's segment, and I'm looking forward to next week where we will continue to talk about all things sports. Tonight, we talked about what was going on in the Western and Eastern Conference Finals with the Los Angeles Lakers leading the Denver Nuggets in this series of 2-1, and they play again tonight, Thursday night, so that should be a good game as well. And be on the lookout for the Miami Heat versus Boston Celtics to see if the Boston Celtics can stay in the series or if they'll just be eliminated. And in the NFL, basically talked about the new quarterbacks in fantasy football and the WNBA and what they're doing in their bubble as their playoff series have just started. This concludes this week's segment on Go Sports Crazy with your host, DJ Takeoff, only on Penguin Radio. Thank you.